You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner to English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is Collected Works, Volume 178 by Rudolf Steiner. It is an appended lecture to the book Secret Brotherhoods, and it is Lecture 9, even though the book itself only has 7, so this is the two that are in the German original. And so this is Lecture 9 of that series, in Part 2 of Psychoanalysis and Anthroposophy. Yesterday I described what is called analytical psychology, or psychoanalysis, as an effort to gain knowledge about the soul by inadequate means. Perhaps nothing is as well suited as psychoanalysis to show that in our time everything urges us toward anthroposophical spiritual science. Yet at the same time, people resist a spiritually scientific consideration of reality because of their unconscious prejudices. Yesterday I gave you examples of the grotesque leaps the thinking of our modern erudition necessarily makes when it dares to approach soul problems. And I showed you how to catch modern scholars at these leaps in their reasoning. I pointed out that one of the better psychoanalysts, C.G. Jung, categorizes people as belonging either to the predominantly thinking type or to the predominantly feeling type. On that basis, he assumed that in people of the thinking type, unconscious feeling impulses rush up against the thinking in the conscious mind, and thus lead to soul conflicts. In the other type, Jung assumed thoughts from the unconscious mind rush up against the feeling life and cause soul conflicts. Now you might say that these things will be fought out in scientific discussions, and that we can wait until people make up their minds to overcome their unconscious prejudice against anthroposophical spiritual science. But passive waiting becomes impossible when such things do not confine themselves to the theoretical field, but are encroaching upon practical life and cultural development. And psychoanalysis is not content to limit itself to therapy alone, which might be less alarming, since there seems to be little difference, I said seems to be, between it and other therapeutical methods. Instead, it is trying to extend itself to pedagogy and to become the foundation of a pedagogical approach. This makes it necessary for us to point out the dangers in quarter-truths more emphatically and more seriously than would be called for by a mere theoretical discussion. To discuss this matter fully will take quite some time, but today we can begin by enlarging the scope of our consideration and casting light on one or the other of its aspects. First of all, I would like to point out that the facts available to psychoanalysts are really suited to lead them to a spiritual realm modern people do not wish to enter, at least not in an accurate manner. Rather, they would prefer to leave it as a sort of nebulous, unconscious region for our current outlook, ailing with materialism even in this domain. Let me read that again. Rather, they would prefer to leave it as a sort of nebulous, unconscious region for our current outlook, ailing with materialism even in this domain, loves nothing more than a vague, mystical floating among all sorts of unexplained, undefined concepts. We find the most grotesque, the most repulsive mysticism right in the midst of materialism, if you take mysticism to mean a floating about in all sorts of nebulous ideas without working out one's world view into clear, sharply defined concepts. The contents of soul life push the psychoanalysts into the domain of extra-conscious intelligence and reasoning activity. I have often dealt with these matters, only indicating them and without going into details, since they are taken for granted by students of spiritual science. In the process, I have often reminded you that reasoning, intellectual activity, or cleverness are not confined to human consciousness, but are everywhere, that we are surrounded by effective mental activity as we are surrounded by air. Rational activity surrounds us and all other beings like a cocoon. The facts available to the psychoanalysts might easily lead them to this insight. I quoted to you yesterday a case described by Jung. It had to do with a woman who, having left an evening party with other guests, was frightened by horses and ran in front of them along the street to the river where she was rescued. She was brought back to the house she had left, where her host declared his love for her. From the standpoint of Freud or Adler, the case is easily explained on the basis of the drive for love or that for power. But this diagnosis does not touch the vital essential foundation of the matter. Its foundation is reached only by realizing that consciousness is much more than the cleverness and calculation, the cunning and craftiness of what works in us as intellect, and by realizing that the laws of life are not limited by the laws of consciousness. In the case we have discussed, we can at least ask what the woman really wanted after she had been at the party and had seen her friend depart for the health resort. She wanted to create the opportunity for what actually happened, namely to be alone with her friend's husband. Of course, this had nothing to do with what was in her consciousness, what she was aware of and would have owned up to. It would not have been proper, as we say. Something had to be brought about that she would not have to own up to. We will find the true explanation by taking into account her subconscious, cunning intellect, of which she herself was unaware. Throughout the entire evening, she had wanted to be alone with her host. People who are not so clever make a poor choice of means to reach their objective, but those who are cleverer make a better choice. In this case, we can say that in the woman's ordinary consciousness, which admitted scruples as to what was proper or improper, allowed or not allowed, the effective and direct means to achieve the end in view could not have been chosen. But in what was stored below the layer of ordinary consciousness, the thought was incessantly active. I must manage a meeting alone with the man. I must make use of the next opportunity that presents itself to return to the house. We can say that if the opportunity with the horses had not offered itself, supported by association with the earlier accident, she would have found some other excuse. For example, she could have fainted in the street. We can say with a kind of hypothetical certainty that the woman would surely have fainted if the approaching cab had not provided the opportunity she needed. She would have fainted on the street, and people would have carried her back to the house she had just left. If she had not fainted, then she would have found some other expedient. The unconscious ignores all the scruples the conscious mind cannot disregard. The unconscious takes the attitude that the end justifies the means, whether they harmonize with our ideas of propriety and morality or not. In such a case, we are reminded of what Nietzsche, who knew something about many of these things, called the great reason, in contrast to the small reason. The great reason is the all-inclusive reason that does not come into consciousness, but acts below the threshold of consciousness, and leads people to do many things they do not own up to in their conscious mind. To the ordinary, outer consciousness, human beings are connected with the world of the senses, the whole physical world, and all that lives in it. To this physical world belong also all the concepts of propriety, of bourgeois morality, and so forth. All of this is part of the physical plane, and human beings are equipped with a consciousness relating them to that plane. In our unconscious, however, we are connected with an entirely different world, which Jung says the soul needs because it is related to that world. But he also says that it is foolish to inquire about the real existence of that world. Well, that is how it is. As soon as the threshold of consciousness is crossed, the human soul is no longer in a merely material context or environment, but in a realm where thoughts rule that may be very cunning. Now, Jung is correct in saying that especially people of our time, the so-called people of culture, need to pay attention to these things. For this so-called contemporary culture has the peculiarity of pressing numerous impulses down into the unconscious, impulses that then assert themselves in such a way that irrational behavior, as it is called, and irrational conduct result. When the drive for power or that for love are mentioned, It is because, as soon as the human soul enters the unconscious regions, it approaches the realm where these drives rule. It is not these drives themselves that cause the irrational behavior, but the fact that the person plunges with his or her unconscious intelligence into regions where these drives are in effect. The woman in our case would not have gone to such great lengths and have involved her unconscious cunning for anything that interested her less than her love affair. She had to have a special interest in the matter, and that the love impulse so often plays an important role is simply because the love interest is so very common and widespread. If psychoanalysts did not focus so much on psychoanalytical sanatoriums, where the majority of the patients, it seems to me, are women, the same reproach is cast on anthroposophical events, but I think with less justification. If psychoanalysts were more experienced in other fields, as some of them are, and if there were a greater variety of cases in the sanatoriums, they might gain more extensive knowledge. Let us assume that a sanatorium was established especially for psychiatric treatment of people who had become nervous or hysterical from playing the stock market. Then one could introduce quite different things into the unconscious on the same basis that Freud introduced the love impulse. Then we could use the extensive unconscious cunning processes of the people who play the stock market. Then, through the usual methods of elimination, sexual love would be seen to play a very small part, and yet the subtleties of unconscious cunning and slyness could be studied at their height. Even the drive for power could not always be designated as the primary impulse, but altogether different drives would be found ruling the regions into which our soul descends when we enter the realm of the unconscious. If, in addition, a sanatorium were established for scholars suffering from hysteria, it would be found that what works in their unconscious can rarely be traced back to the drive for love. For those with any knowledge in this field realize that under present conditions, scholars are seldom drawn to their chosen science by love, but by quite different forces that would be revealed if brought to the surface through psychoanalysis. The all-embracing truth is that the soul is led from the realm of the conscious down into the unconscious regions, which can become conscious only with the help of spiritual science, where our drives and instincts rule. These drives cannot be mastered because we can conquer only what is in our conscious mind. There we have another inconvenient truth. Of course, it forces people to realize that in their unconscious mind, human beings can be very sly creatures, and much more cunning than they are in their ordinary conscious mind, more cunning than even the psychoanalysts are prepared to admit. In this field, we can have some strange experiences with ordinary science. You can read about these experiences in the second chapter of my new book, Riddles of the Soul, which will be published soon. In that section, I deal with what the academic Dessoir dared to write in the chapter on anthroposophy in his book Beyond the Limits of the Soul. This second chapter of my Riddles of the Soul will be useful for thinking people who want to form an opinion about the morality of present-day scholars. You will see, when you read this chapter, what kind of opposition we are dealing with. Of the points mentioned in my book, I will here bring up only a few that are related to our present theme. Dessoir has all sorts of objections to this and that, and always refers to passages taken from my books. In a very interesting context, he tells how I distinguish consecutive cultural periods, the Indian, the ancient Persian, the Chaldean, Egyptian, the Greco-Latin, and now we live in the sixth, he says, according to Steiner. This proves that we have to refute these statements in a schoolmasterly manner, for it shows us the way to confront such an individual. How does Max Dessoir come to assert, in the midst of all his other nonsense, that I said we are living in the sixth post-Atlantean cultural epoch? It may be easily explained if you have any practice in philological methods. I worked for 6.5 years at the Goethe Archives in Weimar and learned a little about how to use the philological methods, so I can easily show through these methods how Dessoir came to attribute to me this statement regarding the sixth cultural epoch. He had been reading my book, An Outline of Occult Science, in which there is a sentence leading to a description of our current fifth post-Atlantean cultural period. In the sentence, I say that things are prepared over long periods of time, and in one paragraph I explain that events taking place in the 14th and 15th centuries were prepared in the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries. About five lines further on, I say that the 6th century was a preparation for the 5th cultural period. Dessoir, as is typical of him, read only superficially, and later checked hastily, as many a scholar does, the place he had highlighted in the margin with a red or black pencil, and confused what was said about the cultural period with what had been stated earlier about the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries. Thus he speaks of the, quote, 6th cultural period, close quote, instead of the 5th, because he had skipped a few lines. You see, the grand superficiality such a person works with. Here we have an example of how such, in quotes, scholarship may be shown up philologically. This entire chapter in his miserable concoction is riddled with such mistakes. And while Dessoir claims to have studied a number of my writings, I could prove philologically what books this number comprises. He read and partly understood the philosophy of spiritual activity, for he devotes a sentence to it that is utter nonsense. And he read an outline of occult science, but in such a way as to end up with the kind of stuff I have just described. In addition, he read the small work, The Spiritual Guidance of Man, and the little booklets, Reincarnation and Karma, and Blood is a Very Special Fluid. This is all he read, as is clear from his essay. He read nothing else. That is the morality of our present-day scholars. It is important to expose the erudition of our time in such a context. Out of the great number of my books, he chose such a very small amount to read, and then he bases his whole argument on them, and with distorted thinking to boot. Indeed, many of our scholars these days do exactly the same thing. When they write about animals, for example, they usually have about as much material to base their observations on as Dessoir had. Quite a pretty chapter could be written if we studied Max Dessoir's unconscious mind. He himself, however, in a special passage in his book, provides the opportunity for us to take his unconscious into account. Grotesquely enough, he relates that when he is lecturing, it sometimes happens that his thoughts go on even though his soul is no longer present with them. He thus continues to speak for a while until he realizes from the reaction of his audience that his thoughts have gone in one direction and his attention in another. He tells this quite naively. Just think, on that basis he then proceeds to discuss all kinds of peculiarities of human consciousness. I have pointed out quite gently that Dessoir here reveals himself. At first I thought he could not possibly mean himself. He must simply identify with other clumsy lecturers, and therefore he speaks in the first person. It would be unreasonable to think that he is describing himself, but he really does exactly that. Well, in the discussion of such matters, many odd things will be noted. He deals with, titled The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, in one comment, by formulating a trivial sentence that is Dessoirish and did not originate with me. The whole thing is crazy. He says in that passage, quote, Steiner's first book, The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, close quote, well, since that book is the culmination of 10 years writing activity, I have to draw your attention to this spouting of academic paranoia, to such academic madness as an example of many scholars' ethics. I know, of course, that although I have shown in my book that Dessoir's presentation is corrupt, people will say again and again that Dessoir has refuted Steiner. I know it very well. Trying to break through what people nowadays imagine they have long since got completely rid of, namely belief in authority, is like talking to the wall. But in particular, this chapter in Dessoir's book will prove the difficulties spiritual science must struggle against in contemporary culture, simply because it insists on clear, sharply defined concepts and concrete spiritual experiences. There is no question of logic with such an individual as Desoir, and a lack of logic in the broadest sense characterizes our contemporary so-called scientific literature. These are the reasons why official erudition and official spiritual trends, even if they work themselves out of such extreme inferiority as the psychiatry or psychology taught in the universities, will nevertheless never get anywhere. They lack the basic requirement, namely a genuine observation of life. So long as it is not widely realized how far from genuine research and from a true sense for reality those things are that pose nowadays as scientific literature, I do not say as science, but as scientific literature, and that often form the content of university lectures and popular talks, so long as this trust in authority is not broken, nothing good will come of it. These things must be said, even if we have the deepest respect for scientific thinking and for the great achievements of natural science. That these things influence life in such contradictory fashion must be realized. Well, after this digression, let us return to our subject. Desoir finds it especially aggravating that, as he maintains, in a combination of objective untruth and slander, I said in my little book titled The Spiritual Guidance of Man, that there is an important unconscious working of spiritual impulses. I pointed them out by showing that while a child builds up his or her brain, a greater wisdom is at work than the one we later become conscious of when the brain is completed. A healthy science ought to take its starting point from such normal workings of the unconscious, but it would still need something else. When you read my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, you will find there a discussion of the secret of the threshold. In my explanation of this secret, I show that after we cross the threshold into the spiritual world, a kind of separation takes place, a sort of differentiation of the three fundamental powers of the soul, thinking, feeling, and willing. Remember, in that same book, I explained in the description of the guardian of the threshold that these three forces, which work so closely together in ordinary consciousness that they can hardly be separated, now become independent of each other. If I sketch them, this narrow middle section, and there's a drawing, is the boundary between the ordinary consciousness and that region where the soul lives in the spiritual world. Thinking, feeling, and willing must be so drawn as to show this as the range of will, and it's in red, but bordering upon the realm of feeling, which is in green, and this in turn borders upon the realm of thinking, which is in yellow. But if I were to sketch their paths after crossing the threshold into the spiritual world, I would have to show that thinking becomes independent on the one hand, feeling separates itself from thinking, and will becomes independent too. In other words, thinking, feeling, and willing spread out like a fan. You will find this described in more detail in my book Knowledge of the Higher Worlds. It is only because the threshold has a certain breadth in which our I lives that these three activities can interact properly and without getting confused. When our I, capital, is healthy, when it has perfect soul health, then the interaction of thinking, feeling, and willing is so regulated that they do not merge, but only mutually influence each other. This is the essential secret of our I. It keeps thinking, feeling, and willing side by side, so that they affect each other in the right way, but do not merge. Once we cross the threshold into the spiritual world, there is no danger of such a merging, because then the three faculties separate. Certain philosophers, such as Wundt, for example, insist that the soul must not be described as threefold because it is a unity. Wundt, too, confuses everything. The fact is that, in the spiritual world, thinking, feeling, and willing originate in a threefold manner, yet in the soul on earth they act as a unity. That must be taken into consideration. When people claim, as they have recently done, that anthroposophy distinguishes actually three souls, even though there is only one, and that therefore there is no justification for anthroposophy, then we must point out that the unity of the human being is not impaired by the fact that each of us has two hands. The drawing on the previous page shows the relationship between the soul forces working in and with the eye, as well as the way they work on the other side of the threshold of consciousness in the spiritual world. However, a different condition can come about if the eye has been weakened in any way. Then the threshold is crossed, as it were, in the opposite direction. Then thinking swerves aside, mingles with feeling and willing, and confusion results. This happens when thinking is in any danger of not being properly confined, so that it asserts itself autonomously in the conscious mind. Then, because the eye is not working as it should, thinking slides into the sphere of feeling or of will. Instead of working side by side, thinking merges with feeling or will, because the eye is, for some reason, unable to exert its normal control. This is what has happened in the cases categorized by the psychoanalysts as hysteria or nervousness. Thinking, feeling, and willing have swung to the opposite side, away from the healthy direction that would lead them into the spiritual realm. If you have any gift for testing this, you can easily see how this develops. Take the case of the woman sitting by her father's sickbed. Her formerly strong eye consciousness has been diminished through loss of sleep. The slightest thing might cause her thoughts to leave their track alongside her feelings and fall into them. Then the thoughts would at once be submerged in the waves of feeling, which are far stronger than the wave of thought. And the result in such a case is that the whole organism is seized by waves of feeling. This happens the moment thinking is no longer strong enough to hold itself apart from feeling. It is an important demand placed on human beings that they learn more and more to hold their thinking apart from the waves of feeling and will. If thinking takes hold of the waves of feeling in the unconscious, something abnormal results in the organism. There's a parenthesis C drawing. At the right is the supraconsciousness, in the middle the consciousness, at the left the unconscious. Close parenthesis. This is extremely important. Now you can imagine that in our modern life, when people are confronted with so many things they do not properly understand and cannot really penetrate, thoughts continually run over into feelings. However, only thinking is oriented on the physical plane. Feeling is no longer confined to the physical plane, but by its very nature is connected with the spiritual plane as well. Feeling really has a connection with all the spiritual beings who must be considered real. So that if a person with inadequate concepts sinks into his or her feeling life, he or she comes into collision with the gods, if you like to put it that way, but also with evil gods. And all these collisions occur because the person entered this realm without any reliable means of knowledge. Entering the feeling life without adequate means of knowledge is unavoidable when there is more going on in the sphere of feelings than in that of ordinary reason. In the sphere of feelings, human beings cannot liberate themselves from their connection with the spiritual world. When they free themselves in the realm of the intellect in this materialistic age, they enter the world of feeling with inadequate concepts, and consequently must become ill. What, then, is the only remedy to really restore people to health? They must be guided to concepts that reach out to include the world of feelings. That is to say, modern people must again be told of the spiritual world in the most comprehensive sense. The therapeutic methods of the psychoanalysts, which are adapted to the individual, are not what is needed, but rather spiritual science, which applies to all humanity. If people really take in the concepts of spiritual science, and not everyone who listens to lectures or reads about them really takes them in, if people really absorb them, it will not be possible for thinking, feeling, and willing to intermingle chaotically in the unconscious. This chaotic intermingling is at the root of hysteria and nervousness, which are psychological symptoms and are the subject of psychoanalysis. However, all this requires that we have the courage to approach a direct experience of the concrete working of the spiritual worlds, the courage to realize that we are living now in a crisis connected with the one we have found in the year 1879, whose painful aftermath we are still suffering. I told you yesterday that many things must be looked at differently than the materialistic outlook of our time does, and I referred to Nietzsche as an example of this. Nietzsche was born in 1844. In 1841, the battle in the spiritual world began, of which I have already spoken. And for 3 years, Nietzsche was in the midst of it. Richard Wagner, born in 1813, at first took no part in it. So Nietzsche lived in the spiritual world for 3 years after the battle had begun. He absorbed all the impulses he could under the influence of this battle and brought them down to earth with him. If you read Nietzsche's early writings, you will notice his pugnacity. Almost every sentence shows the after effects of what he experienced spiritually in the 3 years from 1841 to 1844. This gave a definite coloring to all the writings of Nietzsche's early period. As I have pointed out, another important event was that Schopenhauer died when Nietzsche was a boy of 16. Nietzsche then began reading Schopenhauer's works. A real relationship developed between the soul of Schopenhauer in the spiritual world and that of Nietzsche on earth. Nietzsche read every phrase of Schopenhauer so receptively that the author's impulses from the spiritual world could enter into him. Schopenhauer had ascended into the spiritual world in 1860, when the battle was still raging. What was his objective? What did he want? Under the influence of the battle, Schopenhauer wanted to see his thoughts, rather than his works, continue into the future. Nietzsche did indeed continue Schopenhauer's thoughts, but in a peculiar way. After passing through the gate of death, Schopenhauer saw that he had composed his writings in an epoch when the spirits of darkness were approaching, but had not yet arrived on earth. Thus he wanted to have his thoughts and the impulses growing out of them continued into the future. That is, as he was confronted by the battle of the spirits of light against those of darkness in the spiritual world, Schopenhauer wanted to have his writings continued. He formed in Nietzsche's soul the impulses to continue his thoughts. What Nietzsche's soul received from the spiritual world at that time contrasted sharply with what was happening on the physical plane in his personal relationship with Richard Wagner. This is how Nietzsche's soul life, as well as his career as a writer, developed. Then came the year 1879. The battle had been raging in the spiritual realms, began to be transferred to earth after the spirits of darkness had been flung down. Nietzsche's whole karma, in which I include his concrete relationship to the spiritual world, exposed him to a certain danger, namely the danger of being driven into very evil paths by the spirits of darkness. Schopenhauer had, as it were, a transcendent, egoistic motivation. His soul was in the spiritual world, and inspired Nietzsche to carry on his work. This is a transcendent egoistic motivation lasting beyond death. After all, egoism is not necessarily always bad. But when Wagner entered the spiritual world in 1883, the spirits of darkness had already come down. Thus, he entered into an entirely different atmosphere, so to speak. He became Nietzsche's unselfish spiritual guide. We have to speak about things here that are paradoxical, but are nevertheless true. Wagner did not make Nietzsche carry on his work, but allowed him to remain in the current appropriate for him. And Wagner did Nietzsche the favor of letting him become mentally deranged at the right moment to keep him from getting into dangerous regions with his conscious mind. That sounds paradoxical, but this is how unselfishly Wagner's soul worked upon Nietzsche from realms that were purer than those where Schopenhauer's soul had acted, who had still been in the midst of the battle between the spirits of darkness and the spirits of light. What Wagner wanted to do for Nietzsche was to protect him in his karma, as far as possible, from the spirits of darkness, which had already descended to earth. And indeed, Nietzsche was protected from these spirits to a great extent. If you read his last writings in the right spirit, you will find great thoughts there, especially if you separate out the strong resistances or the things that have developed out of them. In my book titled Nietzsche, A Fighter for Freedom, I try to show the mighty thought impulses detached from all his conflicting impulses. Yes, the world is deep. There is really some truth in Nietzsche's saying, quote, "The world is deep and deeper than the day divine," so close quote. So we must not criticize the vast regions of the spiritual life with our ordinary consciousness. The wise guidance of the world can be understood only if we can enter into concrete aspects of that guidance while staying free of egoistic thoughts, and if we can see even tragic events in the development of the world as part of the wisdom-filled course of things. If you really want to look into the heart of things, you will come upon many uncomfortable places. In future, if people really want to understand a life like Nietzsche's, they will not get anywhere if they describe only what happened in Nietzsche's environment here on earth. Our view of life must be extended to include the spiritual world. This necessity of extending our view of life is made more than obvious by the phenomena the psychoanalysts face today and try in vain to master with inadequate means of knowledge. Society would be drifting into difficult situations if it accepted and complied with psychoanalysis, particularly in the field of pedagogy. Why is this so? Consider the fact that thinking slips down into the sphere of feeling. Now, as soon as we live with our soul in the sphere of feeling, we are no longer in the life limited by birth and death, or by conception and death. Instead, we then live in the whole world, which extends beyond the usual lifespan. In the realm of feelings, we live also in the period between our last death and our birth into this present life, and with our will, we live even in our previous incarnation. Imagine educators trying to work on the basis of psychoanalysis and their relationship with their students or patients, and trying to deal with soul content that has slipped down into the realm of feeling. Such an educator approaches not only the individual life, but the all-embracing life extending far beyond the individual. Concerning this all-encompassing life, however, the connections between people cannot be exhaustively described by means of mere ideas, but lead instead into genuine life connections. This is very important. Imagine such a connection between a psychoanalytic teacher and a student. What would take place there could not be confined to the realm of ideas being conveyed to the student, but real karmic connections would have to be established, because one is intervening much more deeply in life. In such a case, the individual in question would be torn out of his or her karma. The course of his or her karma would be changed. It will not do to deal with what extends beyond the individual in a purely individual manner. Instead, it must be treated in a universally human way. We have all been brought together in a certain time period, so there must be a common element that acts as soon as we go beyond the individual. In other words, individuals cannot be approached in therapy or education by individuals as psychoanalysts do, but something universal must enter. Even into the general culture of the times, something must enter that points the soul to what usually remains in the unconscious. And what is brought up into consciousness must become part of the milieu, not a transaction between individuals. Here, you see, lies the great mistake that is being made. It is a far-reaching and tremendously significant mistake. Instead of trying to permeate cultural life with knowledge of the spiritual world, as it should be in our times. The psychoanalysts shut all the souls that show how repressed spiritual life becomes pathological into sanatoriums and treat each one individually. This can only lead to the forming of confused karmic connections. What takes place between the individuals does not result in bringing to light the unconscious soul content, but in a karmic bond between doctor and patient, because it encroaches upon the individual. You see, this leads us into real concrete life, and we must not play with that. Real concrete life can only be mastered if nothing else but what is universally human is striven for. These things must be learned from the concrete relationships of human beings to the spiritual world. Therefore, it would be good if people could stop talking abstractly, as Jung does, saying that the individual experiences everything humanity has gone through, even all sorts of demons. But Jung makes them into abstract demons, not realities, by saying that it is stupid to discuss whether they exist. He makes them into abstract demons, mere thought demons, that could never make anyone ill, and that could never live in the unconscious, but only in the conscious mind. That is the point. The people who accept such theories are themselves working with so many unconscious ideas that they can never come up with the right thing. Instead, they end up making certain concepts absolute. And I have to repeat again that when we begin to make ideas absolute, then we come to a dead end, or we reach a pit and fall into it without thinking. A man like Dr. Freud is obliged to extend the sexual domain over the entire human being in order to make it account for every soul phenomenon. I have said to various people who have approached me with psychoanalytic tendencies that a theory or worldview must hold its own when you apply it to itself, otherwise it crumbles into nothingness. The simple logical fallacy, if you extend it far enough, is an example. A Cretan says all Cretans are liars. If it is said by a Cretan, and if it is true, then it would be a lie, and the statement would cancel itself out. It is not possible for a Cretan to say all Cretans are liars and assume that this statement applies absolutely. This shows the pattern of absolutizing, but every theory has to be applied to itself without crumbling. If you apply Freud's theory to Freud as he brings up unconscious soul content into consciousness, then you have to say this theory is merely the outcome of the sexual life. Just as the statement that all Cretans are liars would be a lie, if coming from a Cretan, so does the theory of the universality of the sexual drive crumble if you test it out by applying it to itself. And it is the same with other things. You may understand this principle for a long time without applying it vigorously in accordance with reality. It will be one of the special achievements of anthroposophically oriented spiritual science that it can be applied to itself in this way. The end of Lecture 2.